Hi there, this is Ron Myers from the Consulting Room, and it's my pleasure to invite again Chris Hammond, who's the Managing Director at Exact Group, and Kelly McManus, who's an Employment Law Solicitor and HR Advisor for Exact as well. Exact provide a fantastic free service called Business Assist for our Consulting Room members, and that's an online portal with a very comprehensive set of documents and guidance for health and safety and HR requirements that many of our members rely on. But they also provide additional bespoke services around HR and health and safety that many larger clinics use as well. So, Chris and Kelly, I know we've had you on a few times during lockdown. I know that, Chris, as well, the last few months have probably been the busiest that you've ever been at Exact. So is it easing up at all?
No, I was hoping, from our side, and I think in the general business point of view, that the latter stages of July and the beginning of August, where people perhaps started to take holidays or were getting back into their businesses, that it would cool down a little bit in regards to our own advice, particularly in the HR and employment law spheres. But no, that doesn't seem to be the case, and I'm sure Kelly will pick up the type of cases that we've had to deal with, but it seems to have moved from one area to another. So obviously the main focus at the beginning was on furlough, and now it's on business restructures. So that seems to be the main point of focus. And you know, the particularly on the business restructures, they can be quite complex processes, and you know, they take a bit of time. So the HR and employment law team have been excellent. They've been under a great deal of pressure, but they continue to provide a really good service. So it's been a shining light for us.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, Kelly, I know that you provided some fantastic advice on furlough in previous podcasts that we've done. So before we get into some specific questions, because really what I want to do is to look more at, as furlough's starting to end, different options that clinic owners have. But could you give me just a few broad updates on furlough since the last time we spoke, please?
Okay, so there has been an update literally within the last 10 minutes. The first one relates to what employees that are on furlough, what redundancy pay they're entitled to receive. Mm-hmm. So you might have seen in BBC News and other news articles today that there was discussion about a change to the law on this. So normally what happens if you have an employee that doesn't have fixed working hours and, you know, has variable hours, normally, in order to calculate the redundancy pay, you would work out what the average would be over the previous 12-week period. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the problem that we have at the moment is that there is no average pay because they haven't been paid because they've been on furlough for the last 12 weeks. Yes. So the government of today announced that they're putting through emergency legislation to change that. I've just literally received the email with the draft legislation, and whilst I've been on this podcast, I've managed to quickly find out what it is that they're saying. So the changes will come into play from tomorrow, and it will mean that how you calculate that redundancy pay will be just on the 12 weeks prior to when they went on furlough. So you just to make it in oversimplistic terms, you just disregard the furlough period.
Okay.
There is a lot more to it. There is more technical points to it. So I would definitely suggest that you get specific advice when it comes to calculating it, because if you make a mistake, then you're potentially up for a claim from the employee for underpaying their redundancy. So that could be in the form of either unfair dismissal, unlawful deduction of wages. There's a variety of potential claims that could arise. So that's one important change to highlight. Another change is something that has also been in the news quite a lot. And again, that's with the minimum period for self-isolation for coronavirus.
Mm-hmm,
so
yes.
Previously, the guidance was that you would self-isolate for 7 days if you had symptoms or if you'd received a positive test result for coronavirus, but that has now been changed and it's now 10 days. Now, what this means in effect is that obviously if any members have employees that have to self-isolate, they will have to allow them the 10 days rather than the 7.
Yeah.
There hasn't been any discussion as far as I can see yet on what that means for statutory sick pay. However, haven't read the guidance about statutory sick pay and the legislation that was put through to take into account coronavirus, it doesn't appear to specify a minimum period that you have to be self-isolating or a maximum period. It's simply just the general rule, which is you're only entitled to it on day four of a sickness. Yep. So that would also then translate to day four of when you start to self-isolate. It would just mean then that you would get 10 days statutory sick pay for the self-isolation rather than the current 7 days. So that's obviously quite an important change. Another change, well, it's not really a change, but something that the government have announced is the quarantine on arrival from particular countries. At the moment, the one is Spain, which has been advertised. They have said that there might be other countries that they add to that list.
Yeah.
So it's just a case of waiting and see, you know, waiting and see what they do. But at the moment, what they've said is, you know, if you're traveling to Spain, you come back, you have to quarantine for 14 days. Now, obviously, that puts employers in a bit of a difficult situation because they've already had their employees off for whatever period for their holiday. And obviously, they need to still continue trading. And that's quite difficult if you've got staff members that are having to quarantine for a further 14-day period after what might even already be a 14-day holiday.
Yeah.
So what the legal position on this is that employers shouldn't subject their employees to any sort of detriment or punishment for having to do this, because obviously this is completely out with their control. A lot of these people have obviously been on holiday at the time this was announced, so it's not as if they could have put any sort of, you know, backup planning in place because they weren't aware of it.
Yeah.
So at the moment, there is no legislation to say that any further time that they need to take off should be paid. So there is no legal right for the employees to be paid during the quarantine period.
Okay.
Therefore, my advice is that ideally the employer should have a conversation with the employee to see what the options are. Mm-hmm. One option might be that they take a further period of annual leave, but that might not, you know, that might not be a good option if they've not got enough annual leave to use.
Sure.
But at least it would mean that the employee is getting paid for the period that they're having to quarantine.
Yeah.
Alternatively, if they can work from home, obviously, absolutely, you know, try and utilise the ability for the employee to work from home.
Yeah.
And if that's not an option, the next one, you know, is really unpaid leave, because that is, you know, there is no other legal protection for the employee. So the employer is not under any obligation to pay the employee when they're quarantined. The only difference to that would be if they have symptoms of coronavirus, because at that point they may then be, you know, they may qualify for statutory sick pay.
Yeah.
But there is no, you know, you can't get statutory sick pay just for quarantine. That's not how it works.
Okay.
So, yeah, there are some options, but obviously it's not great. And even if, you know, even if the employee is going on the unpaid leave for 2 weeks, you know, it's not great for relations anyway between employer and employee, because the employee is then losing out financially, and the employer is as well, because they've not got that person there to do the work. But unfortunately, you know, again, it's a lot of this is out with their control. But what I would definitely recommend is, given that we know now, and they've made it quite clear that other countries are likely to be added to the list,
mm-hmm.
I would suggest that employers have a policy on yep. what should happen in this event, and that way they've got something clear that they can point to. And if they make, you know, employees aware of that before they go, the employees are then understanding that it's at their own risk if they then decide to go abroad, because they know what the consequences will be, i.e. they know if they go on holiday and they have to quarantine when they return, that they might have to quarantine on unpaid leave for those 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And if, you know, the employee is made aware of that in advance, and, you know, in the form of a policy, then again, it lowers any risk that an employee might have against an employer to say that was unfair.
Yes.
Or again, it also just, it keeps that communication open. And it means that you're not having to have these difficult conversations with staff to say, look, we just can't afford to pay you for those 2 weeks, because yeah. at least then they'll know what the position is if they go away, despite the fact that clear government advice is to say, look, you know, don't book a foreign holiday. So that's what I would recommend for that situation. And again, this is something, something we can, you know, we can draft. We can draft some documents on that. A policy itself is not contractual in nature, so you don't need to have an employee's consent to it. It's simply just a policy of the company to say this is how we will deal with the situation if it arises.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just keeps everybody on the same page, which I think is would be quite useful for a lot of companies, given that, you know, we're in these really uncertain times at the moment.
I wholeheartedly agree. And of course, you know, this is not just over the summer months. It could be, you know, people want to go away skiing or whatever. We just, none of us really know what's going to happen over the next 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or even a year, do we really? So, but I agree with you. I mean, I think at least then the employee understands that the risk is on them if they come back and, you know, as you say, have to quarantine from a payment point of view, at least. So, okay, fantastic. Thank you very much for that. So quite a lot of new stuff then just in the last few days. My God. So again, you know, from my perspective as well, because with our sort of two teams of consulting room and Hydrofacial, we still got a number of people on furlough, but we are aware now as well that obviously the financial benefits of furlough are starting to tail off. And of course it's going to end, we think, anyway, at the end of October. So we've got another 3 months here of government support. And I think what every business owner is trying to do, and we are as well, is trying to gauge the pickup in terms of the revenue that's going to be needed to support the staff, and then trying to guess whether or not, you know, that revenue is going to be able to support them after October. So could you just give me some of the options really, as we, you know, come to the end of this furlough period, as to what employers could do in terms of supporting staff with either, you know, reduced hours contracts or really, you know, redundancy? What are the options?
So the first one is, as well as, you know, we haven't really spoke about this time, but is flexible furlough as well. That's a good starter point.
Yeah.
So depending on what stage the business is at of reopening or whether they're doing any sort of work, the first thing I would definitely recommend is to consider making the most of the flexible furlough scheme.
Yeah.
Obviously that can only be used where an employee's already been furloughed. They can't use that for anyone that's not been furloughed before. But it means then that they're getting, you know, they're getting some of the work done, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're not having to pay the full costs of that, and it just allows a kind of almost phased return back to work.
Yeah.
So obviously it's good for the business to get that output, and they're obviously been able to get the money back from HMRC for the days that they're not working, so that there's, you know, it's helping both employer and employee. Once that period ends, as you say, it's due to end on the 31st of October. Really the situation goes back to if you can remember back in March, when it was, you know, before furlough was announced, people were asking these questions, and what the advice we were given is they would need to really look at the employees' contracts, and there might be options in those contracts for, you know, for short time working, or for layoffs. They could then potentially utilise those clauses. For example, if there is another downturn in work, or they just simply cannot afford to offer the work when the furlough scheme ends, if it's just a temporary measure, they could utilise those clauses. If they don't have those clauses, or it's a situation where they think, you know, this isn't really going to change, what we would recommend is obviously to look at redundancy.
Yeah.
But before kind of pulling that plug, We would definitely encourage employers to look at what options they have. Can they get additional funding from the government under different schemes? You know, I know there's been discussions about the Kickstarter scheme that the UK government announced a few weeks ago, which is where they're encouraging businesses to employ young people between the ages of 16 and it was either the ages of 16 and 24 or 25. I can't remember what one. But that they would, you know, they would pay or they would cover the costs for a certain period to encourage, you know, young people to get into work. And that could also potentially assist, you know, if there's any, you know, work that needs to be done that you know, the business is thinking, right, okay, we just can't afford to do this any longer, that's another option. Or they could look at getting, you know, business loans. There's definitely more attractive rates and attractive interest, loan rates and things that you can get just now.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if all of that fails, the next step would obviously to start the consultations with the affected staff. So the first thing that the business would need to do is look at the structure of the business and see what exactly, what roles is it that they cannot afford to continue having filled. Once they've then selected those roles, depending on how many of those roles are affected, you would then begin a consultation process. The first kind of step with that is to then have meetings with those affected staff to let them know that their role is at risk. And depending, and this is where it can get technical and quite complex, which is why I would always recommend that people seek advice, legal advice or HR advice about redundancy, because there are specific rules depending on what process you're following. So if you're making more than 20 people redundant, it would fall under collective consultation, which has quite stringent and very strict rules in terms of what the timescales are and what you need to do by a certain date. You mm-hmm. also would need to notify, you need to notify, there's a government agency that you also need to notify to let them know that you're about to undertake, you know, a collective consultation, just surely because of the amount of people that are being made redundant. But I think for most of our kind of clients, it's not, they're not looking at making 20 or more people redundant. They're looking at the, you know, maybe making, you know, a few redundancies, maybe 5 or 6.
Yeah.
So it is a lot easier when it's a smaller group of people. There are specific steps that need to be taken in order to do that. What we normally advise is that once you've selected those roles that are going to be made redundant, that they all get put into what we call a pool redundancy. Okay. And what you would do is then you score all of those employees against each other, as in you put, you know, you would use a specific selection criteria which would assess points that each employee would get based on particular skills or particular requirements that you think are necessary for the role. So for mm-hmm. example, this could be, you could base it on their experience, you could base it on qualifications they have. Other companies use attendance, although you have to be quite careful with attendance, because if there's any absences because of a disability, those need to be discounted.
Yeah.
There are quite a few different kind of selection matrix that can be used, but it's really important that you use one that is, you know, as fair as possible, because obviously those roles are all going to be compared against. And you don't want an employee, you know, you don't want some employees arguing that it's unfair that they're being assessed against a different person for something that might put them in a more difficult position if it's something they can't avoid, for example, a disability, which means that they're not able to be, you know, to have as high an attendance record as somebody else because they have regular time off because of their disability.
Sure.
So it's very, very important that the selection matrix that is used is one that is fair.
Yeah.
And that's why, as I said, we would recommend that clients take legal advice on that, because if you know the penalties for getting that wrong can be quite significant,
yeah.
because those with over 2 years service can obviously bring an unfair dismissal claim, and the amounts that can be claimed can be quite significant. And on top of that, redundancy is one of those kind of situations where it's really important you follow a fair process, because a failure to do so would automatically result in the dismissal being unfair.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one, isn't it? And you know, I've been through this a few times in my career, and it's not an easy process, both actually from a particular emotional perspective, obviously dealing with the individuals involved, and also, you know, as you say, just taking advice and making sure that the process and documentation behind it is correct as well, so to make sure that you don't, you know, kind of trip up really. So I guess, you know, the thing I'm kind of looking at from an employer perspective here as well is just the difficulty of being able to predict the future. I know it's difficult at the best of times, but I think particularly now in terms of looking at, I guess, where we might be next year. And part of this, I guess, is making people redundant, but then potentially, who knows, if things pick back up quickly, having then a need then for people back a couple of months later. And I know there can be issues there potentially, can't there, as well, if you've been seen to make a position redundant and then almost opening that position up again as a vacancy a couple of months later.
Yeah, because then it's viewed on as, well, if you've made that person redundant, why are you then recruiting for that same role again? Because ultimately, it's not a person that you're making redundant, it's the role.
It's the role.
So that role should no longer exist. So if you're then looking to recruit for that role 3 or 6 months later, then you've not followed a fair process, because, you know, it's not the role that's been made redundant, it's the person. Yeah. And that's where employers can get into difficulty sometimes, because it is difficult to separate the two. And obviously, as you've said, it's uncertain times, so you just don't know what the situation is going to be like in 3 months' time or 6 months' time, never mind 3 days' time, you know, given all the updates that keep coming. What we always kind of recommend is, our first advice would be to not recruit for that same role for at least 6 months. Okay. The reason for that is because most employment tribunal claims, most of them have a 3 month time limit. However, there has been a lot of pushback and a lot of arguments by the unions to the government to try and get the timelines extended because of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So my worry with that is that, you know, eventually the government might agree to look at extending the time limits, or at least they will be more sympathetic to people bringing claims out with the time limit because of the sheer impact that coronavirus has had. Yeah. Because it's affected every single sector and everyone. So getting legal advice during this time can still be pretty difficult. So my advice is still to, if you can, to not recruit in the 6 month period. Otherwise, you're running that risk that you've got an unfair dismissal claim on the back of it, because they're going to make the argument, well, the role wasn't there, and now 6 months later it is. And it's just, it's not even about, you know, obviously if you've got good grounds for it, that's fine, but it's not even necessarily about defending it and having a good having good prospects of being successful in defending it. It's the sheer amount of management time that you'll incur trying to defend it, because it can get quite complicated. And at the moment, the employment tribunal system is completely backed up. So it can be something that's then left hanging over you for, you know, could be up to a year, 2 years. But obviously, if the business needs to make that decision, then they need to make it. But it is just something to be wary of.
It's a tough one, because, you know, if you're running a small clinic, let's say with, I don't know, 3 or 4 therapists who are involved in dealing with treatments, but you really feel that you can only support, let's say, 3, you know, coming out of lockdown. And, you know, obviously as well, there's difficulties in terms of looking at, use of the rooms, flow of patients coming in because of, you know, all of the issues associated with infection control. But, you know, clearly, though, it could be that, you know, you ask someone to leave and then a few months later the position, you know, you may have a demand there. Can you, I don't know, off the top of my head, can you make someone redundant and then re-employ them again?
Yeah, there's nothing to stop you doing that unless there's something in the contract that they've negotiated to say that they wouldn't do that. For example, public sector organisations, they normally have a clause in their contract that specifically prohibits that, just purely because obviously redundancy payments are coming from the public funds. Yeah. So obviously they can't be seen to be making large payouts and then re-employing that person a few months later, because that would be quite clearly a use of public funds. But absolutely. And, you know, there are other things that, you know, can be done as well, even looking at, you know, offering a different role, you know, framing it as a different role so that it's not identical to the one that you've made redundant.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are some things you can do, I guess, to be creative.
Yes, I know what you mean, yeah.
Although that goes against all my lawyer instincts, but...
Well, I think...
But there are...
Yeah. There is an element. I mean, I think, you know, as a business person, it's always trying to look at, I think, those kind of shades of grey, isn't it, really? And trying to see, you know, where is the wiggle room amongst, I guess, you know, the law, I suppose. You know, especially in a position like now, which is, you know, very, very difficult for a lot of business owners, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think a lot of them are very torn between, you know, and clearly the government is trying to say, keep these people on board. And not only that, if you do at the end of furlough, we'll give you a bonus as well. You know, so that's the £1,000, isn't it? If you do keep someone after furlough. But then there is the commercial realities of really, well, if you really don't think that person, you're going to be able to afford that person, or they're going to be able to contribute to the profit of the business next year, then you do have that maybe, as you say, 6 month or longer time lag between making someone redundant and then, you know, who knows, a bounce back happening quite quickly, and then being able to bring them back. I presume actually after the, I don't know about, I haven't looked into this, if you get the bonus after furlough, how long do you have to leave them before you can make them redundant?
I'm not actually sure on that specific question. I know is that the employee just needs to still be employed, I think, by February 2021. Yeah. I don't think there's any, as far as I'm aware, I don't think there's any technical legal requirement that they need to be retained for a certain period after. I think as long as they're employed by the cut-off date in February, after returning from a period of furlough, I think you're entitled to get that bonus. Yeah. Obviously, HMRC are constantly reviewing the situation and constantly making changes to the rules of the scheme. So I would anticipate that they will have something in future that specifies that there might need to be a repayment if an employee leaves by a certain date, but I'm not aware of there being one at the moment. But as I said, I've not looked into that specific point, because again, yeah, I think it's just the situation that you've already said, that, you know, you there's only so much planning you can do when things are changing so much, and that's kind of the nature of the beast, is just trying to keep up and making decisions based on the information that you have at that time. So yeah, I think as long as the decision that you're making, i.e. if you're going down a redundancy process right now, whatever decision you reach during that can only be reached in accordance with what information you have at this time. So, yeah, you know, 6 months down the line, if, you know, rules change, or even for example, this clarification and this change about how, you know, the statutory redundancy payments should be calculated for those on furlough, that in itself, you know, is, when you look at it, there will already be employers that have already made people redundant and have done it on the old calculations. Now, they can't be penalised for that.
Yeah, I know.
The law was correct at the time they made that decision. So even today, if somebody did it today, they would still be within the, you know, they would still be acting within the law, because the law doesn't change until tomorrow. So, yeah, you know, they can't retrospectively penalise anybody for that. So again, I think as long as the employer's looking at the relevant information that they have at the time, and that's really important, because I do think, or I do see some kind of common mistakes being made, is that, you know, employers are just simply kind of panicking and it's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, and they're not really considering the wider picture or looking at alternative options. Because one of the duties when you're undergoing redundancy is to consider suitable alternative employment. So, for example, if you're closing one area of your business and say it's a junior member of staff that works, you know, in an administrative role, that person could potentially work in another area of your business. And there might be some scope for that. But, you know, it's not that you need to do that. You just need to show that you've considered it. You know, you need to show that you've considered that option and then make a reasoned decision as to why that's not appropriate. So, for example, there might be too many staff in the other department, or there just might not be a vacancy. And that's fine, but it still needs to be considered. And we would always recommend that written records are kept to that, even if it's just, you know, file notes of, you know, making a redundancy plan and having internal meetings. And as part of those meetings, you've discussed what the options are. All of that is still good evidence, just in the event that it is challenged at a later date. But yes, absolutely. Just considering what you have in front of you at the moment, and not, I suppose, trying not to worry too much about what might change or might happen in the future.
Yeah.
Which I know is harder, you know, harder said than done, but it's one of those things that we're just in uncertain times, so we just have to try and go with what we have as best as we can.
Okay. Could you give me an idea of what the kind of normal time scales are for making someone redundant, if it's, you know, if it's not complicated, if it's just a single person you're making redundant?
So if it's just, if we're not going down, if it's not any more than 20 employees and we're not, you're not needing to go down the collective consultation route, then there is no set legal timeline. There's no legal requirement for how the consultation should take place or how long it should take place. However, what we advise from an HR perspective is to ideally be looking at somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks, because what you really need to do anyways, you need to obviously have your selection matrix that I spoke about earlier. You need time to actually be able to complete that. And we would also advise that you have at least 2 consultation meetings with the affected members. And we would also recommend that those are done individually. So you should have the first consultation meeting with an employee that's affected to basically tell them what's happening, you know, give them notice of what the selection criteria is going to be, and ask them to put forward their comments on it, or if there's anything that they think that they could offer, i.e. if they've got any suggestions that could help avoid the need for redundancy, then the employer would then go away, obviously complete that selection matrix, send it to the employee, and again then arrange a second meeting to, once they've had the you know, the completed selection matrix, have that meeting with the affected employee again to then discuss what their views are on what's been put forward, kind of like how you would do a performance review.
Yeah.
You know, you would send a blank template to the employee, you would complete one, and then they would then complete their points. It's kind of similar to that.
Okay.
And then once you've had those 2 meetings, then obviously a decision would be made, and then you would just, you know, the employer would then need to just communicate that to the employee, but they don't need to meet with them again. They could just do that by, you know, sending them a letter or having a phone call. We definitely recommend at least having a phone call, because obviously it is a very sensitive situation, and you know, it should be handled very sensitively. And obviously if you're being made redundant, you don't really want to be just sitting by the post waiting for a letter. You would hope that, you know, you're notified of it, you know, before, so that you're not just sitting there waiting, because that's not obviously that's not a situation for anyone to be in.
Okay, fine. So, I mean, in your experience, what are the kind of the main problems that employers encounter when going through the redundancy process?
Main problem for us, I think, even just my experience in the last few weeks alone, is that some employees take it personally.
Yeah.
So they take, you know, the any talk of redundancy as being a personal attack, as opposed to it's a business need, and that it doesn't matter how good the person is at their job, it doesn't matter how many, you know, years service and how loyal they are, and you know, it's that's not the reason for the redundancy, but some employees just struggle with that.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's understandable. Again, you know, we're all, you know, at one point or another, or have been employees. We know how difficult it is if you're relying on that income every month, especially during a pandemic. You know, it's very, very difficult time, and when things are uncertain and you don't know if you can pay your bills or not, it's an awful thing to go through. And sometimes people, you know, a reaction to that, a normal, you know, psychological reaction to that is to be defensive. Unfortunately it makes things a lot more difficult to go through the process, because, you know, that ends up sometimes, as I've got a couple of cases at the moment, you know, where employees making all sorts of, you know, subject access requests, they're wanting, you know, a lot of detail that they're not entitled to, they're arguing with, you know, every single point, and drawing things out and making it quite painful for both parties. And again, it's something that it isn't really something that can be avoided, but one thing that's very important is just remembering that when you're conducting these consultations or you're doing this process, just remember that these are people at the end of the day and they are losing their livelihood. So yeah. It's just about having that, you know, sensitive approach and having open communication and making things as clear as possible, you know, as giving them, you know, giving them the information, the business case, showing them, you know, look, this is what our, you know, our forecasts, our profit and loss, you know, accounts are. This is our business forecast for what we've got coming in. We're spending this amount of money on this department and this amount of money on this particular role. Our anticipated income just can't meet that, you know, and just showing them that so that they know that there is no other hidden reason or hidden agenda for doing it, because there will be some employers who will be using this time to get rid of employees that they just don't want, as opposed to being genuine redundancy. So it's just about being careful how you approach it. And if you can give your employees as much information as possible, it's great, because it's helping the process go along. And it also means that if it does turn messy, you've got a lot of written evidence to show that you've acted reasonable at every stage, so that you're protected if it comes to an employment tribunal claim.
Yeah, I agree. I personally think actually the redundancy process is probably the most difficult personal thing that you have to manage as a business owner or as a manager, really, you know. And it's challenged me over the years when I've had to do it. And you're right, it is incredibly sensitive. And I think your advice is absolutely spot on. You're going to be really open in terms of looking at, you know, the business case behind why you feel there just isn't the role there for that person, and make sure they really understand the business case, rather than them thinking, as you say, somewhere along the lines that they're just trying to get rid of me because, you know, I don't fit in or whatever it is. So I think that's really important.
I love a lot for employees' well-being as well, because I know there's a lot of studies, you know, carried out by CIPD and other professional bodies that show that this is one of the biggest things that someone can go through in their life, and the long, you know, there can be long-term effects of it.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, whilst as a business you're trying to make that decision, you also have to balance that against the fact that, you know, you are making a decision that can, you know, have such a huge impact and change somebody's, you know, life, especially if they've got families and things, you know, responsibilities to pay. And it's a very, very difficult process.
Well, that's right. And the other thing as well, I think, and I've spoken to lots of business owners as well who've ended up almost supporting their staff and actually virtually taking nothing out of the business because they can't actually base the process, because they know and understand that, you know, the employment has helped that person with their own lifestyle and mortgage and kids and that kind of, they get wound up in that and then can't actually make the decision which will help the overall health of the business and maybe the other staff as well. So that's the other point, because what you can end up doing is if you're not running your business appropriately, you can end up jeopardizing the whole business, which could be all the whole team and your livelihood, rather than, you know, that one person, even though it is incredibly difficult. So challenging all around. So one final thing, I think just relating more, I think back to furlough, I think at the moment at this point in time, and flexible furlough, and then people coming out of furlough as well. What are the kind of things that people should be aware of? Because it's obviously very fluid and flexible, but regarding documentation, communication with staff, especially when furlough ends, is there anything that people need to be aware of? Is this pretty seamless when furlough ends? They just kind of, you know, come back into work full time.
So again, there is no sort of minimum legal requirements or anything that you must do. But my advice is generally, as it is for quite most of the things, have an open communication with the staff. Just giving them informal updates, you know, each time that, you know, if you're as a business, you're watching the government updates, you're seeing what the changes are. If that affects your, you know, particular industry, you know, just simply do we update to your staff, because it's likely that your staff have been watching that as well. So they'll be thinking, well, what does that mean for me and my job? Yeah. And it's better to get ahead of the game. So it's better for you as the employer to take control of that and send an email out to say, look, we're aware that this has been announced by the government. We're considering matters and we'll be making decisions in the next few weeks. Or, you know, just giving staff an indication of what's going on so yeah. that they know what to expect, and they can then, you know, obviously plan ahead as well, because, you know, you would want, what I've kind of suggested for a lot of clients, and particularly in your sector as well, is you would need to set up, you know, some return to work training.
Yes.
So, first of all, making the workplace COVID secure. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information and guidance on the government website. That's split into 8 different sectors. It's different, again, according to what country you're in, Scotland, England, Wales and Ireland.
Yeah.
We also, I mean, take advice. I mean, we have our health and safety team that we consult, who draft, you know, risk assessments and things for employers to use, which should be carried out ideally before employees go back to work.
Yeah.
And then sending out copies of the risk assessments to the employees before they return and asking them if they've got any specific concerns, because this can be a good time to get, you know, to get through all the concerns that employees might have before they go back to work. Because as soon as they get the go ahead, which, as you've seen with today's, well, in Scotland today, we had an announcement to say schools are reopening on the 11th of August. Mm-hmm. We're at the 30th of July, we've got 11 days. You know, how do we make sure everything's ready to get schools back and teachers back in 11 days? Yeah. But for businesses like, you know, in the sector that yours are in, you know, you can plan ahead. You know, you've got that time, and so use it well. Keep in touch with your staff, do the risk assessments, you know, read up on the guidance that the government have produced. Just, you know, as much planning as possible and discussion with employees, so that when it comes time for them to come back, you've already got everything, all the paperwork and things in place. So it should be a much more seamless process.
Yeah.
And also, it keeps the employee relations good. It means that people know where they stand, and they're not, because I know that, you know, even just from a personal point of view, I've had a lot of my friends that are on furlough, you know, a lot of friends that work in gyms and things, and, you know, they're frustrated. You know, they know, because they see the government updates to say that, you know, because again in Scotland our gyms aren't open, and they're seeing the news to say that the government are saying that the gyms can't open, but their employers aren't keeping in touch with them, so that news is updated, and then a week later they're still not hearing anything from their employer, and they're getting frustrated at that.
I can understand.
Quite a common pitfall, I think, because, you know, employers are, and I get it, they're busy obviously planning and organizing things, but, you know, it is important, because obviously if you don't have the staff, then, you know, you've not really got much of a business, so it's definitely having that.
Absolutely. Well, I wholeheartedly agree with you again, Kelly. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things is, I think when you've got a team, is, you know, the good, open, honest, regular communication, you can't actually beat it. And I think particularly regarding furlough, and obviously, you know, if you are going to go through any sort of redundancy side of things, I absolutely 100% recommend you do not start that process, or even think about that process, without talking to Exact or someone else who can help you reflect on A, the options, and then B, the process that you're going to need to go through to make sure you don't end up with any you know, issues the other side of this, because that's the last thing you really need at this point in time. Is any form of tribunal, you know, with the position that we're in. So just finally then, thank you, Kelly. That's absolutely brilliant. Finally, Chris, I know you've been fairly quiet because Kelly's kind of the expert in this, but is there any other sort of general advice that you might want to give people at this point in time regarding anything really to do with sort of the HR side of things?
No, I think Kelly covered it very well, just at the final point that she made in regards to members of staff returning back to work, and really the things that should be in place prior to employees and businesses returning back to normal activities. You know, this is a really good time to obviously make sure you have planned out things efficiently, and you've got consultation with the staff that will be returning back to work. So I think it's just really using your time wisely to make sure that you've got, you know, COVID secure workplace. You know, you're doing the business restructures now, you know, whilst we have the time, and you're really looking ahead as far as you can, obviously taking you know, we're all taking assumptions on various different things, and you've really got to use your intuition. You know, being a business owner and having run a business for probably a number of years, you know, making those judgments, because I suppose that's what we're all there for. You know, you've got to make those strategic decisions to make sure that the business there, yes, thrives.
Brilliant. Well, thank you again, as ever, Chris and Kelly, for your fantastic support for our members and also for the information you've given us. And I'm sure we'll probably speak again before the end of furlough as well, because I'm sure there'll be other updates and other things that will come through. But thank you very much again. And obviously, I'm going to post your details alongside this podcast as well, so people can get in touch with you if they need additional help and support. So thank you very much. And hopefully enjoy the rest of the summer. Cheers.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.